The first point is that I'm talking about history, the idea of history and doing history. That is, it's completely different from reading history books or historical novels or something like that. In fact, it goes backwards. You realize that. If we try to do history, we always have to go backwards. And it's quite ridiculous that the history books always start at the beginning and go ahead in time. Because really, that way we start from the point where we know least. After all, we have to have records to do history. And we start from our own situation. And we work backward. We have to use written records. And we know our own languages, for example, more or less. And we know our own writing systems. We know our own writing systems. And these are what we use. But as we go, try to work back and back and find earlier and earlier records to dig back in the, through all the papers of earlier times, trying to do history, we find that we reach the origin of our languages and the origin of our own writing systems. And that is not the beginning of history. Now, how can this be? It can only be because in history, some languages have died, and some writing systems have died. Now, how can a writing system die? If you've got page one, the first paragraph is useful, actually, for that. How can a writing system die? Does anyone have an idea? How can a writing system die?
Yeah? When they needed to use it, when they didn't.
Yeah. If you got page one, you got the answer. If you got page one, you got the answer. But it's a very strange thing. I mean, we take writing for granted, and yet there are many cases to prove that writing systems in the past have been used when needed. And if through various changes, problems in a culture, that writing system is no longer needed, people will give it up. People will give it up, and they will even just stop writing altogether. This has happened. God knows, it could happen again. But the point is that the writing systems are not automatically continued. And this is a serious problem for us in trying to dig back into the history of the ancient Near East. Now, writing systems can die. One point is that sometimes people cease to need a certain writing system, or in some cases they can actually cease to need writing altogether. Now, what about a language? How can a language die? This has happened many times also. How can a language die? What do you think?
Yes.
Well, that's one way.
Government intervention. A perfect point is Ireland, where they
right. 200 years ago.
Right, and then, and of course, it's not easy to revive a language if, well, all right, people, all the people might die. That probably has happened, although it's not recorded, of course.
The Tuscan, no, the Tuscan were assimilated by the Romans, the Tuscan language was
yes.
not spoken anymore.
Sure. There's various kinds of assimilation.
Yes.
They don't have to die.
No.
In many, many cases, people have just sort of been surrounded by people with a different language, or they have been overcome by another culture whose language seemed, in some way or another, more desirable to use than their own. Doesn't really die unless they stop teaching it to their children. And with the language, it doesn't really die unless the schools close. I mean, you'll have to stop learning the writing. When all the schools close, another way is all the schools close, then there's no more of that kind of writing. You might think of other ways that these things could happen. Anyway, these two points are very important when we try to look back into the history of the ancient Near East. We've run into precisely these two problems. We're trying to deal with languages that have gone completely out of use and with writing systems which also have gone completely out of use. Not only that, the most important ones went out of use more than 2,000 years ago. More than 2,000 years ago, so that for a long, long time in the West, people had not really a clue to understanding those ancient languages, because, of course, they looked around, they didn't find anybody who could speak those languages. They knew there were ancient Egyptians, but they didn't find anybody claiming to speak Egyptian, and they didn't find anybody claiming, well, actually, they did find a number of people claiming to read hieroglyphs, but it was all bogus. And the same way with the Near East, where I suppose you all know that cuneiform was the most common, in Mesopotamia, most common system of writing. Now, where there was continuity in writing systems, then it was possible to follow these records back and back and back. And with this, though, there was a limit to this, because there was a time when our writing system was not used, and its ancestors were not used. What kind of writing system do we have? We have two to deal with here among us. What kind of writing system do we have? We have an alphabet. We have a system, I mean, both Arabic and English have alphabetic systems, right? So, not only that, but they're related. They look very dissimilar. But in fact, they're quite related, and we can follow those alphabets back. In fact, we can tell system, writing system, is always adapted for the language for which it is developed. And then other people can borrow a language system. The regular Latin alphabet, which serves all of Western Europe now and many other places, was clearly not made it was not invented to serve an Indo-European language. It was not invented to serve English or German or French. It was not invented to serve Latin or Greek. How can we tell? We can tell because there are some signs that are useless. There are some signs that are really useless, and the reason is that they are vestiges of the original alphabet. So we have this letter. Q. Of what use is this letter? We put it together, we do things with it, but in fact, you know, that the sound of this, without a U after it and so forth, the sound of this in European languages generally is not different from this. Again, we have another letter. If we want to write QU, we can put KW. Why do we have this extra sign? The reason is that this alphabet was invented to serve a language, in fact, a group of languages, that made a real distinction between these two sounds. I mean, they were two different sounds, and they made up two different signs because they had two different sounds. And this is true in Arabic now. We can tell from Arabic and other remains, modern manifestations from the same family of languages, that this was this hub. And the Greeks, when they got it, didn't know what to do with it. They dropped it. When the Romans got it, they had it for a while. The Romans got it. They kept it, but there was still, even in none of those languages, was there a real need for that letter. Now, I'm going to continue talking about these two sounds as I go through. So, these alphabets were related. This goes back to the Phoenician alphabet. You probably know. Seems to go back to Proto Sinaitic, the earliest signs that seem to be the ancestors of these were found in various short inscriptions in Sinai. They're very early, remarkably early, but still, I mean, they go back perhaps 2,300 BC. But there are very few examples of that. Really came into full use maybe around the end of the Bronze Age, beginning of the Iron Age. That's when we start to have lots of records in alphabetic writing. Okay, here's the alphabet. Now, so we have records in alphabets that we can figure out. We can follow our own letters, our own signs, back and back and back, watch the changes, and go back in, especially with West Semitic languages, languages from this area, this region, from back into, clearly into the Iron Age, and in bits and pieces further back. But people were able to do this starting from what people knew in Western Europe after the Renaissance. People followed this back and they studied Greek, you know, Latin, Greek, Hebrew, so forth. They followed all this back. And then when other early records in alphabets were found, it was not difficult for people to learn to read those records. But there were many other records that no one could read. No one could read. The writing of ancient Egypt, and the writing, the main system of writing of ancient Mesopotamia, the hieroglyphs and cuneiform writing. Should I write these down? Or does everybody know? Does everybody know those? No? Okay. Be brave. Be brave. That's okay. Okay? I have the old writing of Egypt, the pictures in the writing of Egypt on hieroglyphs. And the signs from ancient Mesopotamia, all made on clay with a pointed stick called, we call it cuneiform writing. Okay? And you have examples if you have the right notes. Some of you still need some examples of this. Okay. If your handout started with page 3, your handout started with page 3. You don't have, you have these, but if it didn't, okay. If your handout started with page 1, you still need this. These are some examples of cuneiform signs. Oh, let me ask you that here. That's what I've got for now with these. Now,
page 7.
Gonna have a few. Yeah. Well.
Some more of these.
Sorry about these problems with that. Handout. The same people will need these eventually. And these. Page 6, page 7, and a general table. See if you can get one. Okay. Now, there's one more here of page 7. Anybody need 7? Okay. Now, so there was a real barrier, and it's amazing. It's amazing to say that, you know, when people read all the, say, ancient Greek writings about Mesopotamia, and when they read the passages in the Bible about Mesopotamia, the total of information that they had, then, using alphabetic records, using alphabetic records, was really very, very small. Very small. It seems that the Greeks had, for example, had very, very little information, real information, about the life, the history of the people of Mesopotamia before their time. At least the records that came down to us gave very, very little information. Now, the problem then, if, I mean, civilization in ancient Egypt. They could see the remains of it. The same way for Mesopotamia. But nobody could read those records. Nobody could read what they wrote. And they could as people from the West started to travel more and more to these lands, more and more examples of this crazy, these crazy signs kept coming in, flowing in, and people tried to do something with them, but there wasn't much could be done. The problem was to break through this barrier, you see, and the problem was not so much problem of language, because it was possible to see that, say, the languages of old Assyria, old Babylonia, were like other what we call Semitic languages, like Arabic, like Hebrew, like Phoenician. You see? So, they must have languages like this. But even then, you see, with this break, clear break in the writing system, with no information passing across that gap from the world that was before, the world that was recorded in those cuneiform tablets or on those reliefs in Egypt. There were, with no information coming across from before that, from before, say, the Greeks, from those early civilizations, people were really at a loss. There was no way, really, to cross that barrier. Now, in the case of Egypt, let's see. What do you think now? What do we need in a case like this? We have writing. We have a lot of records. But it's in a writing we do not know. We have a general idea. These people, we know where they lived. We have an idea when they were there. But we can't read that writing. What do we need? How can we cross that barrier? Right. It sounds very simple. All we need is a translation. Something, one message written twice. Once in this old writing, this old language, and once in a known language, a known writing system. Or even better, something like a little Arabic-English dictionary, something like that would be very nice. But for a long time, you see, there were no records that gave us that key to unlock all that information that was just sitting there, you see, waiting for someone to read. Now, in the case of Egypt, everyone was very lucky because some of Napoleon's soldiers just dug up just what we needed, one nice translation, you see, known language, Greek. Unknown was the ancient Egyptian, even gave us two forms of ancient Egyptian. One, the very carefully cut pictographic sort of signs that were carved on the temples and on the reliefs. And the other, the normal kind of writing, sort of a shorthand for that, which was used regularly in the records that they wrote on papyrus in ink. So, very nice, very nice. This way, after 1799, there was a great breakthrough, and it was possible to read the records of Egypt. Because that happened first then, the first claimant for the cradle of civilization was Egypt. Why? Well, just because it happened. People could read what the ancient Egyptians wrote after that. They could not yet read anything from ancient Mesopotamia. Now, in the case of Mesopotamia, the problem was much more difficult. Much more difficult. There was no translation. Still, say, 50 years later, there was no translation that gave us known language, and known writing system, and then the unknown translation of it. You see? The only way that was found was there were translations, right? But the translations were entirely in cuneiform. There were translations from one unknown language in this unknown writing system into another language also in this unknown writing system. I mean, it was clear. You can count the signs and so forth. You can see that you've got two different uses of the writing. You can see you have two different languages, but still two or even three, sometimes three languages, none of them could be read. Now, we try to go back and do this. We have to see how many signs there are. You know about cryptograms, right? We all know about cryptograms. The greatest cryptograms in the world are these. Now, the key record then was, by chance, the Byzantine inscription, which was a little difficult to get at. It's carved in a cliff on a mountain in Iran. Why did we have to go to Iran to get the key record for Mesopotamia? Well, we need this translation, you see. The record found by Napoleon's soldiers was not really a record from old, old Egypt. It was needed at that time because the Greeks took Egypt. The Greeks took Egypt, and when they went there, I mean, the Egyptians didn't need to write a translation, right? They could read that stuff. I mean, the people that could read it. But who needed the translation? The foreigners coming in needed a translation. And therefore, documents were written after the Greeks took over. They wrote these translations. Or they got the priests, the Egyptian priests, to write the translations. Now, those were the people that needed it. And this record from Egypt was a decree from a Greek king of Egypt after the conquest by Alexander the Great. They were the ones who needed a translation. And therefore, they made it. And lucky for us, they did. Because then we get the bridge, the link, to enable us to go from what we know of history into another world of records, into a whole different writing system, and so forth. But in Mesopotamia, it didn't happen quite that way. The Greeks didn't, or at least we haven't found, a translation from the Greeks. It seems that the oldest languages, the main ones, for the people of ancient Mesopotamia were already dying when the Greeks, or even dead, when the Greeks came. even the Greeks did not need a translation into those languages. They didn't need it, I suppose, or else we haven't found it. Before the Greeks, other foreigners took Mesopotamia. Other foreigners took Mesopotamia. Before the Greeks, the Persians. The Persians. And it turns out it was the Persian king who needed to produce a translation from the old languages of Mesopotamia into his language, Old Persian. As I say, though, it was very difficult to get at this. There were other copies. They were all lost. The only thing that was left for anyone to see was this inscription on a cliff on a mountain in Iran. Clearly, from the sculpture, clearly a record of the Persian king, knew about the Persian kings from the Greek writers. So we could cuneiform writing. In fact, the latest kind, which is at the right-hand side of this chart. Now, even the old Persian was not really known. Persian, of course, is a living language. Persian is a living language. But it has gone through many changes. So first, it happened while people from Europe were becoming interested in ancient Egypt, ancient Mesopotamia. They were traveling more to the east, so on and so forth. A lot of people from the East India Company did a lot in archaeology between here and India. Now, some of them, some of these Europeans, some French, some English, became interested in the old Persian language separately. They heard about this, about the Zoroastrians, the Parsis in Western India, and their language. They started to translate the old religious texts of the Persians. And from this, you see, gradually, people were building up information to get back to the early Persian language. Very well. We can go back to Old Greek. We can go back to Old Greek because it's written in an alphabet. It was written in an alphabet all the way back through ancient classical times. No problem. They say the Hebrew alphabet was preserved. No problem. The Persians were not so lucky. There were times when the Persian schools closed and their writing died. It happened twice. That was a big problem, you see. How to cross over here? Modern Persian is written in the Arabic alphabet. Before Islam, before the Islamic conquest, it was written in a different alphabet. Okay, we can get back to that. But we get back to the old Persian records. We missed it again. It was not written in an alphabet. It was written in this cuneiform script. What can we do? Well, that gets to be a very complicated story. I just want to say that the problem was much more difficult, and it was necessary to go through various clues. If you want me to talk about that more, I'll do it another time. Anyway, Rawlinson was the nut who went to Iran, climbed up on this mountain, and told a little shepherd boy to hold the rope while he hung down, and hung down in front of this cliff and copied about, I don't know, for a single 100 paragraphs, say 300 lines, something, of the Bissetun inscription. And if he had fallen, I suppose nobody would have tried it for a long time after that. Anyway, he was lucky. The shepherd boy held the rope, and Rawlinson got his copy. That was the only way to get it. Took it back, and then it was possible to study this long inscription. Now, I must say, the reason for going, there were other little records from ancient Persia, but you know, if we want to figure out an unknown script, we need long messages to get the idea of the language. We can't just have a few words. That will not help us. That's the problem right now with Etruscan, for example. Crazy, why can't we read Etruscan? Well, it's just because we have a little inscription here, a little inscription there. Not enough, not sentences and paragraphs, not whole long messages that will help us to read that writing. The big thing about the Bissetun inscription, with all of its problems, even though the three languages were all written in unknown script, it was long, plenty long, so that you could learn a lot about those ancient languages if you could hold on to the rope long enough to copy the whole inscription. And Rawlinson did that, and then he had all the information, and he, I'm surprised really, that he really managed to digest all of that and to produce the translation of the whole thing. Anyway, when he did that then, he had to start from the Persian, which was the easiest, then from that, go to the Babylonian and on to Elamite, which I won't bother with. Now, people knew that the Assyrians and the Babylonians had a Semitic language. And that was part of the help when Rawlinson wanted to decipher that script. At least, we didn't know the language. Nobody knew the language, but at least we had an idea of the kind of language. That was true for the Persian, the Old Persian, and that was true for the Babylonian. Well, very well. But the big surprise, after people then broke through and started to read all these records from ancient Mesopotamia, the big surprise was that Babylon was not the first great city of Mesopotamia. And the Babylonians and the Assyrians were not the first rulers of Mesopotamia. Because when they finally broke through and started to read this cuneiform script, they found more translations, other languages, you see, written in this old script. That's the way it goes, right? Once you get the writing system, you can then follow and follow and follow and see however it was used. It can be used for many different languages, and cuneiform was used for many different languages. Now, there was another language there, and as often, I don't know, there's a disease that scholars have that sometimes makes them try to block other scholars for years and years and years. There was one guy that looked at this other language and said, well, this is not a real language. This is just a secret, like a cryptogram, secret signs of the priests, the Babylonian priests, the Assyrian priests, just made up some signs to write secret messages. Well, now I want to try to show you why we say that there was another language. It's been proven in other ways, but in the records, what do we get? Now we look, I'd like you to look here at page 7 first, I guess. Or do you want to take a break? I don't know. Time for a break. Okay. I'll do it quick now. In the library of Ashurbanipal, great late king of Assyria, even before Rawlinson, many tablets were found. And among the tablets then, as soon as the writing could be read, they found translations. They found what we didn't expect. I made a joke earlier, but they found, just like what we said, they said that it'd be nice to find a dictionary, like an Arabic-English dictionary. Well, that's exactly what they found. They found whole dictionaries, whole grammars, in two languages, and they were regularly in Akkadian, that means the language of the Babylonians and the language of the Assyrians. That's the same. There's one language, really, for the Babylonians and the Assyrians. Now I'll show you, this language is like Arabic, it's like other Semitic languages, okay? On the left here, the right here, is the Akkadian, And if we look there, look at the transliteration. In Semitic languages, you have basic system with three consonants for a root. Okay, here you have it. They write down this grammar. This is just a grammar tablet. It shows the grammar of Akkadian, and then it shows the grammar of this other language. Now, if they want to take a verb like pay, to pay, you see what they do? They have sh, pa, lul, three consonants, right? Three consonants. That's two letters, but one sound, right? Sh, pa, o. Okay? That's one root. And then they take that, and they twist it around, they change the vowels, add a little ending here and there, but they take the same consonants, and they use them in many different ways to produce the different forms of the verb. Okay? So that means it's like Arabic, it's like other Semitic languages. It's in the same family of languages. They have another verb, he placed. I can, for those of you who speak Arabic, this one is placed. This root is not much used in modern Arabic, but this one is, the second one now is different. It's sh, k, n, which is the root Sakana in Arabic, in old Akkadian, deplaced, but now it has other ideas of being stationary. Sukun, to stop, to be silent. Sakin, to live, so to stay somewhere, and so forth. This sh becomes s, sin, front s. Okay? Now, this difference is very important in all Semitic languages. We have it in our alphabet because we get it from the Phoenicians. They had a Semitic language. For the Phoenicians, this difference was very important. And if you say, do you know this sound now? To those of you, I'm sorry, excuse me, but those of you who don't speak Arabic, or actually almost anybody who tries, from the West, who tries to speak Arabic, has trouble with a lot of sounds. But those sounds are very important. And if you say kalb instead of alb, you're in trouble. You said dog instead of heart. You see? The difference is very, very important. You said dog instead of heart. Or if you say, the other examples are more complicated. This difference is very important. If anyone makes up a writing system for a Semitic language, for sure, he has to show the difference here. He has to have one sign for this and a different sign for that. Okay? Now look here. This is a syllabary. It's a little different. But you have, for instance, in the first line you have, let's see. He pays, they pay. Okay, they pay. You see the line, the symbol for QA, pa. Third one, he paid. The second sign, we have one sign for ish, one sign for po, one sign for ul, okay? Second sign is for po. Okay, we'll look at this now. Second sign is for po. Q-U, one sign, po, not qua, po, okay? Now, that sign, see that sign? It's like this. That's the sign. Now look down below for the sign for this, who. It's the same. But we know, now if we just look at these signs, we cannot find the difference between P and K, between Q and K. You see? We cannot find the difference. But we know there's a difference because we know, not only in this old language, in Arabic, in modern Assyrian, Syriac, and living Semitic languages, this difference is really important, and we know very well that you, for instance, shakana, you cannot change it. You cannot put a Q for a K. So, this writing system, what's the point? This writing system was not made for a Semitic language. This writing does not work very well for a Semitic language. For a language like Arabic, it's not very useful because there's a very important difference here. There are other very important differences between in sounds. In Arabic, for example, in other Semitic languages, but in these signs, using these signs, they could not do it. They could not show the difference between, say, pa and ka. So, it looks like this writing was not made by the Babylonians, was not invented by the Babylonians, was not invented by the Assyrians. Who invented it? Somebody with a different, not only a different language, a completely different kind of language, a language from a different family. Okay, now let's look at page 6. Go back to page 6 here. We have, again, from the old dictionary, like the Arabic-English dictionary. This is from the library of Ashurbanipal. And we see words in Akkadian. Alfu, you know the word Aleph? The word Aleph. It's Aleph, like alphabet. Aleph in Greek. Aleph in mathematics. It's from Okay. Bull, bull's head, and bull's head. That's the old word for bull, us. Okay? Alpo. But in this other language, it's completely different. Okay? In this other language, it's completely... Oh, you don't have that?
We'll take that one.
Do I have more here? Oh, I have plenty more. Here. I have more of these. Meaning. doesn't mean anything.
You see?
That's not their word for heaven. It's a sign for heaven. It's a sign of a star. You see, it's supposed to be a picture of a star. If you look at your other chart, you can see it. It's a sign of a star. For sure, it means heaven. But that's not their word for heaven. It's the other people's word for heaven. See, on means heaven to these people. On, the sound, on, meant heaven to these people, not to these people. You see? The sign. And when they saw it, when the Babylonians saw this, they said, on. When they saw that, they said, on. But it didn't have a meaning. It had a meaning. This is a sign that means that it started out, you see, if you look at the other chart, it started out like this, picture of a star, maybe. Anyway, for clearly, heaven. But they said, on, that's not their own word. That's a borrowed word, you see? On was the word for heaven to these people that we now call the Sumerians. The Sumerians. That was their word for heaven, and the Babylonians used this sign to say the sound on, because they borrowed the writing. They borrowed this writing from the other people who had a completely different language. Completely different language, the Sumerians. We call them now Sumerians. Nobody knew what to call them for a long time. And with that, we do reach, at last, you see, if we go back and back and back and back, that's the way we have to do history. And finally, we reach the beginning of history in the Near East, in Mesopotamia. Many steps. Sorry, it's very complicated.
If anyone has any questions, please do the doctor.
What I'd like to know
5 hours
is of what would have become of a kumquat without the fuel?
Kumquat.
The fruit. And then let me say, ask something else.
Yeah.
Do you think maybe we are now going through another language elimination of perhaps dramatic modification around the world because of electronic data processing? Do you think this long range will have an effect on what our communications are 1,000 years from now?
For sure.
We'll need an interpretation.
Well, see, history depends on records. And records, in general, until recently, records meant written records. Well, now, the sum of information is being collected not so much in written records. The records are, the tapes, the electrostatic differences on the tapes, or something like this, or video, and such things.
See, we're coming to a case where we don't need to write the old record.
Yeah, could be. But then we absolutely have to have records to run things. And it's just that they really are going into a different form, for sure, yeah.
I'm trying to make a connection between these two alphabets.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. You see, when we see this, we find the only way to explain this is this. In Mesopotamia, the first people there writing were these Sumerians, right? And then the Babylonians, let's say, came along and they took over. They kept the old language, they kept the old writing system, but gradually the old language was used less and less. They kept it in writing, but in fact, probably by about 1500 BC, somewhere between, somewhere after 2000 BC, probably before 1500 BC, people stopped speaking this other language, this Sumerian language. But it was kept in the writing, in the records. Now, this is not an alphabet. This is another system, but I didn't want to go into that. An odd thing is that they kept the system. This is another odd thing in records, that very often we keep an archaic system. We keep, for instance, archaic spellings in English. Why? Why do we keep them? Well, in our education, we want to keep contact with the older records. You see, the older records, the old literature, and so forth. Really, that's the only real reason. I mean, people can yell about other things, but that's the only purpose in keeping archaic spellings. And it was the same way with them. Why didn't they make up another sign for this? You see? Well, they went on long enough without it, and they needed to keep in contact with the old system. The schools kept working the same way, you see. And that kept the writing going, that kept the system going, even if it had a lot of problems.
In fact, in the case of Sumeria, you have a group of people coming in who clearly, according to the historical record, there was a military conquest, and then the older Sumerian writing, later on in the period which we normally call Akkadian, you find that the Sumerian language was used for certain, especially ritual purposes, much in the same way that Latin was used in the Catholic Church long after it ceased to be spoken commonly among the people of Europe. So, in fact, and another thing I wanted to add to what Dr. Gordon said was that there is a system that linguists use to measure the speed with which languages change. And the system, although it's not by any means proven, is called glottochronology. And the principle that it depends upon is the fact that languages will acquire new words or lose old ones, or words will change their meaning at something like a predictable rate. And that has not been demonstrated to be the case, but they can at least trace language types. And so when you talk about a Semitic language, you find there are certain ironclad symptoms of a Semitic language which will not be found in other language groups that are adjacent to it, even geographically, or that overlay it because another group of people come in and take it over. So that system really measures what they consider to be hardcore symptoms of the language, how many of them are left after a certain number of generations. And I'm afraid I can't give you any more specific information on how fast they think a language changes. But we have, of course, the example of our own. If you read 18th century English, you can get a fairly clear idea of how much change is taking place, even in a society where there's a certain amount of linguistic continuity.